All right, let's get started today. We're going deep on early Christianity, specifically the letter to the Corinthians.
One of the most fascinating letters.
Yeah, and we've got your notes or even some excerpts from an academic lecture on the book.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to be like having a front row seat in a New Testament literature class. But
Absolutely.
this isn't just about some, dusty old texts.
Right.
This is about understanding the challenges that a brand new religious community faced. And honestly,
Yeah.
some of their struggles sound shockingly modern.
They do.
I mean, just from glancing at the notes, I'm seeing stuff that,
Yeah.
you wouldn't believe was from 2,000 years ago.
That's amazing.
So did you know that 1 Corinthians is actually the second letter that Paul wrote to this community in Corinth?
It is.
Talk about drama.
There's a whole lost letter in there
The
somewhere.
lost letter?
Yeah.
Wow.
The plot thickens.
And then there's hints that the issues that Paul addresses, things like leadership struggles, social divisions, even a scandal that would make even non-Christians raise an eyebrow,
Thank
might all be connected to the influence of Corinthian culture on this early church.
Absolutely.
It's like watching a cultural clash in real time, and you'll never guess how Paul uses the Old Testament to make his points.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
So let's set the stage a bit. We know this letter wasn't just a random collection of thoughts. It was written to address some very specific problems that the Corinthian church was facing. So before we jump into the letter itself, can you give us a crash course on Corinth? What was it like? Why is understanding its cultural context key to unlocking the meaning of what Paul's talking about?
Well, Corinth was a fascinating place.
Okay.
It was a major port city, a crossroads of trade and culture,
Ah.
which meant it was incredibly diverse.
Oh, wow.
Lots of different people, different backgrounds, different religions, all mixing together.
Sounds a little bit like New York City, maybe.
Yeah, a bit like that.
Okay.
But it also had a reputation for being, well, let's say a little on the wild side.
I was going to say, from what I've read in the notes, Corinth was infamous. Okay, so we're not talking about some sleepy little village.
No, not at all.
All right, so knowing that context then, how do you think that impacted the issues that Paul was addressing? I mean, we're talking about leadership drama, social divides, even a scandal that would make headlines
Oh,
today.
absolutely. I think it's crucial to understand what's going on in the letter.
Okay.
Imagine a city obsessed with status,
Okay.
where your wealth and your influence dictated your social standing, right?
Okay.
Now drop a fledgling Christian community into that mix,
Right.
a community that's supposed to be all about humility and equality.
Yeah.
You're bound to have some friction.
It's like trying to mix oil and water.
Exactly. And that friction
Yeah.
is what makes 1 Corinthians so compelling.
Okay.
It's not just a theological treatise.
Right?
It's a raw and honest response to a community wrestling with how to live out their faith in a very messy world.
So we know Corinth was a bit of a Wild West,
He was.
and Paul was writing to address these very specific problems. But here's what really intrigues me. 1 Corinthians was actually his second letter to them.
Yes, the lost letter
The lost letter.
adds a whole other layer of intrigue, doesn't it?
It really does.
Because we're essentially listening in on the middle of a conversation,
Yeah.
which makes you wonder what happened in that first letter.
What was in it?
What questions were they asking?
What did they say?
Yeah.
It's like finding an old letter in the attic and trying to piece together this family drama.
Precisely. And that missing piece.
Yeah.
It reminds us that Paul wasn't just dictating rules from on high.
Right.
He was engaging in a genuine dialogue, responding to the very real questions and challenges of this community.
So let's talk about some of those challenges.
Okay.
One of the first things that jumps out in 1 Corinthians is the issue of leadership.
Yeah.
Paul calls them out for dividing themselves based on which leader they follow.
Right. It's like they were forming fan clubs around Paul, Apollos, and Cephas,
Yeah.
turning it into a popularity contest.
Popularity contest.
And Paul's response is brilliant. He asked them, "Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you?"
It's such a powerful way of cutting through their ego-driven squabbles and reminding them where their true allegiance should lie.
Exactly. But the fact that this was even an issue
Right.
reveals how deeply ingrained the Corinthian mindset was.
Okay.
They were bringing their cultural obsession with status and influence into the church, completely missing the point of what it meant to follow Christ.
I guess old habits die hard, even when you're trying to embrace this radical new way of life.
And that's the tension at the heart of 1 Corinthians,
Okay.
this clash between worldly wisdom and the wisdom of the cross.
Yeah.
The Corinthians were still operating according to the world's values, power, prestige, influence, while Paul was calling them to embrace a completely different set of values: humility, service, sacrifice.
So how did that tension play out in some of the specific issues Paul addresses? Right. Like, what about that scandal you mentioned earlier, the one that would make headlines today?
Yes. The infamous situation in chapter 5, where a man is living with his father's wife, and the church is not only tolerating it, but boasting about it.
Boasting about it.
Yeah, even Paul is stunned.
Wow.
He calls it a sin not even practiced among pagans.
Whoa, that's saying something given Corinth's reputation.
Yeah.
But why were they boasting? Was it just a case of different times, different morals?
It's tempting to dismiss it that way, but I think there's more to it.
Okay.
Remember the cultural context, inheritance laws were incredibly important.
Right.
And one theory is that the man married his stepmother to keep the family fortune from being divided.
So maybe a financial motive was at play?
It's certainly possible, but there's another possibility.
Oh.
Even more unsettling.
Uh-oh.
What if this man was a wealthy benefactor of the church?
Oh, so maybe they were turning a blind eye to his sin because they didn't want to lose his financial support.
It's an unsettling implication.
Yeah.
But even in their newfound faith, the Corinthians seem to be struggling to break free from the cultural norms that prioritize wealth and status over ethical behavior.
Yeah.
They were falling into the trap of worldly wisdom where the ends justify the means.
It's a reminder that even those who profess faith can still be susceptible to hypocrisy and compromise.
Yeah.
Especially when cultural pressures and personal gain are involved.
Absolutely. And that's precisely what Paul is challenging.
Okay.
He's calling them to a higher standard, reminding them that their allegiance is to Christ, not to cultural norms or personal gain.
Right.
He's pushing them to embrace the wisdom of the cross. A wisdom that values humility, sacrifice, and love above all else.
And how does he connect that back to the Old Testament?
Brilliantly.
Okay.
He invokes the concept of Israel as a holy people.
Okay.
A set-apart community, he reminds them of Leviticus 18.
Okay.
Which condemns incestuous relationships, including a man living with his father's wife.
So he's showing them that this isn't just a random New Testament rule. It's rooted in God's standards for his people going way back.
Absolutely. And then he goes a step further.
Okay.
He reminds them that he had previously called them the temple of God.
Right.
A sacred space where God dwells.
Right.
This man's actions and their acceptance of them were defiling that sacred space.
So he's saying they're treating God's dwelling place like, well, you get the picture.
Exactly. And his solution.
Yeah.
Expel the man from the community, not as punishment.
Okay.
But as a way of preserving the purity of the church.
Right.
Protecting the sanctity of their fellowship.
Wow. That's a bold move, Paul.
Yeah.
I can imagine that didn't go over well with everyone.
It probably caused a stir. But it highlights the seriousness with which Paul viewed this issue.
Yeah.
The church, as God's holy people, couldn't just turn a blind eye to blatant sin, especially when it was being flaunted and justified.
It makes you think about the compromises we make in our own lives and communities, doesn't it?
It does.
When do we turn a blind eye to things because it's easier or more convenient?
It's a question worth pondering.
Yeah.
How do we balance grace and truth? How do we hold each other accountable while also extending compassion?
Right.
Paul wrestled with those questions too, and they're still relevant for us today.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've gone from leadership drama to a scandal that would make even a reality TV producer blush.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else did Paul have to untangle in Corinth?
Oh, get this. Even the Lord's Supper, a ritual designed for unity and remembrance, somehow became another battleground.
Wait, seriously?
It did.
How do you mess up communion?
I know, right?
It seems pretty straightforward.
Well, it's easy to forget that the Lord's Supper wasn't always a simple ceremony we often see today.
Right.
In the early church, it was often a full meal, hosted in the home of a wealthier member.
Okay, so picture a potluck, but with togas.
More like a formal dinner party.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that's where things went wrong. The social hierarchy of Corinth, with its emphasis on status and wealth, seeped into this sacred meal.
So instead of breaking bread together as equals, they were replicating the very social divisions they were supposed to be transcending in Christ.
Sadly, yes. The wealthy arrived first, enjoying the best seats and the finest food, likely served by household servants.
Wow.
The poorer members, often arriving later after work, were left with whatever remained, perhaps even scraps.
Oh, no.
It was a visual representation of the inequality that Paul was fighting against.
It's like those awkward family gatherings where someone gets stuck at the kids' table.
Yeah.
Only this time it's during a sacred ritual meant to symbolize unity and shared love.
Exactly. And you can practically hear Paul's exasperation when he writes, "Do you not have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you show contempt for the Church of God and humiliate those who have nothing?
Oh, wow. It sounds like he's saying, if you want to act like this, just eat at home. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's addressing this fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be a community of believers.
Exactly. Paul is calling out their hypocrisy. They're missing the entire point of the Lord's Supper. The sharing, the unity, the humbling act of remembering Christ's sacrifice.
Right.
Instead, they've turned it into another opportunity to reinforce social divisions and indulge in self-centeredness.
And this makes me think about that phrase we hear a lot, taking the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner.
Yeah.
Usually we think of personal sin, but what if Paul's bigger concern was their communal sin, their lack of love and respect for each other?
That's a powerful insight, and it ties in beautifully with the larger theme of worldly wisdom versus the wisdom of the cross.
Right.
Paul is calling them to a radical new way of relating to each other.
Okay.
One that transcends social hierarchies and prioritizes humility and service.
He's basically saying you can't claim to follow Christ while simultaneously perpetuating systems of injustice and inequality.
Precisely. And this call to examine ourselves before communion takes on a whole new meaning.
Yeah.
It's not just about individual introspection.
Right.
It's about examining how our actions, even in seemingly small things like seating arrangements at a meal, impact the community and reflect our true commitment to Christ's teachings.
It's a powerful reminder that faith isn't just about personal piety. It's about living out that faith in tangible ways within the community.
Absolutely. And this theme of community and how our actions impact one another will continue to emerge as we delve deeper into 1 Corinthians.
Okay.
Remember those two Gentile sins mentioned in your notes?
Yeah.
We've explored the first, sexual immorality. But now let's turn to the fascinating and often misunderstood issue of idolatry in the early church.
Okay, so we've covered sex, money, and power dynamics. It's like a season of Real Housewives set in ancient Corinth.
Yeah.
But you mentioned another Gentile sin that Paul tackled, idolatry. And I have to admit, when I think of idolatry, I picture people bowing down to golden statues. Was that really an issue for the Corinthian church?
It's interesting you mentioned that, because idolatry in Corinth wasn't always so obvious.
Oh.
It was often more subtle, even sneaky, and tied to their social customs. Remember, Corinth was a melting pot of religions, with temples dedicated to all sorts of deities.
But imagine temples on every corner like Starbucks today.
Exactly. And attending feasts and sacrifices at these temples was a normal part of life.
Okay.
A way of doing business, even socializing.
Right.
The problem arose when some Corinthians tried to argue that since these idols were nothing, it didn't really matter if they ate meat that had been offered to them.
So it was like, hey, it's just food, no big deal, right?
That was their logic. But Paul saw a deeper issue at play.
Okay.
One that went beyond a simple dietary choice.
Okay.
He was concerned about the impact on other believers, especially those whose faith was still young and fragile.
It's like telling a recovering alcoholic they can have just one sip.
Exactly.
It completely misses the point of their struggle.
Precisely. Imagine someone who had previously been deeply involved in pagan worship. Someone struggling to grasp this new faith, seeing their fellow Christians casually eating meat offered to idols, could be incredibly confusing.
Right.
And even damaging to their spiritual growth.
No, it's not just about the act itself. It's about the potential for harm and the message it sends to others.
Exactly. And this is where Paul's call for love and sensitivity comes in.
Okay.
He acknowledges that for him, eating that meat isn't a big deal.
Yeah.
He understands that the idols have no real power.
Right.
But he's willing to restrict his own freedom for the sake of those who might be led astray.
So he's saying, I'm strong enough in my faith to handle this, but I'm putting the needs of others above my own desires.
It's a beautiful example of putting love into action.
Yeah.
Even when it means sacrificing your own preferences for the well-being of others.
Okay, so this whole meat dilemma seems to be more about sensitivity than like a hard and fast rule against eating meat.
Yeah.
It's about considering the impact of our actions on others.
Right.
Even in these seemingly insignificant areas.
Absolutely. And this ties back to that central tension in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
Worldly wisdom versus the wisdom of the cross.
Right.
The Corinthians were operating from a worldview where individual freedom and personal gain were paramount.
Okay.
But Paul is calling them to a higher standard, a wisdom that prioritizes love, sacrifice, and the needs of the community.
It's a powerful reminder that following Christ isn't just about avoiding big sins like that scandal we talked about earlier.
Right.
It's about cultivating a heart that's sensitive to the needs of others, even in seemingly small matters.
And this emphasis on love and unity becomes even more crucial when we consider the next section of 1 Corinthians,
yeah,
the discussion of spiritual gifts.
Ah, yes, spiritual gifts, the stuff of charismatic revivals.
Yeah.
But the notes suggest they were causing quite a stir in Corinth. Was it all tongues of fire and miraculous healings?
Well, there were certainly elements of that, but it seems the Corinthians were struggling with the same issues of ego and status that plagued other aspects of their community life. They were caught up in the spectacle of the gifts, often using them for self-promotion or to prove their spiritual superiority.
So imagine church meetings turning into spiritual talent shows.
Yeah.
Each person vying for the spotlight.
Yeah, it's not far off.
Oh, my goodness.
Then once again, Paul steps in to redirect their focus.
Okay.
He reminds them that all gifts, whether seemingly spectacular or seemingly ordinary, are given by the Holy Spirit for a specific purpose, to build up the body of Christ, to serve the community, and to glorify God.
It's like he's saying, don't get so caught up in the wow factor that you lose sight of the why factor.
Exactly. He uses the analogy of the human body.
Okay.
With its diverse parts working together for the good of the whole.
Right.
Each member has a unique role to play.
Yeah.
And all are equally valuable.
So it's a powerful reminder that true spiritual maturity isn't measured by the flashiness of our gifts, but by our willingness to use those gifts for the good of others.
Absolutely. It all circles back to that central theme.
Yeah.
Love. Love expressed through humility, through service, through prioritizing the needs of the community above our own desires.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into 1 Corinthians, it seems like this letter is more than just a collection of rules or theological debates. It's a window into the messy, complicated reality of what it means to be a community of faith, a community striving to live out the radical teachings of Christ in a world that often pulls us in opposite directions.
And while the specific challenges faced by the Corinthians might seem distant to us, the underlying principles are timeless.
Yeah.
How do we navigate issues of power and status?
Right.
How do we balance individual freedom with the needs of the community? How do we ensure that love, not ego, drives our actions and decisions?
Those are questions that every community, whether religious or secular, grapples with. And I think Paul's letter offers some profound insights, even if they come wrapped in the package of an ancient letter to this rowdy church in a city known for its, well, let's just say, lively reputation.
It's a reminder that faith isn't meant to be lived in a vacuum. It's meant to be messy, challenging, and ultimately transformative as we seek to embody Christ's teachings in the midst of our complex and ever-changing world.
I don't know about you, but this deep dive has given me a lot to think about. It's made me appreciate the complexities of early Christianity and has challenged me to consider how I can better live out my faith in a way that honors both God and the community around me.
And that's the beauty of these ancient texts, isn't it?
Yeah.
They speak across centuries and cultures.
They do.
Inviting us to engage with timeless truths and apply them to our own lives.
So for all of you listening, we encourage you to keep digging, keep questioning, and keep seeking ways to live out the radical call of love and unity that Paul so passionately championed in his letter to the Corinthians. Let us know what you discover.